Welcome to Supply Chain Next with your host, Richard Donaldson. Join us as we explore the ongoing evolution of supply chain, from the challenges professionals face every day to the ongoing digital transformation of the entire value network.
And welcome to another episode of Supply Chain Next. I am so thrilled today to have Will Drury. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing that right.
That's perfect.
Awesome.
Drury, except with a D.
There we go. Of course, it's brewery. Anyway, Will, we've been going back and forth. I'm telling you, I'm a huge fan. Kind of, you know, you popped up on my radar just as a fanboy, as it were. I think it was when you popped into Astra, and then from there, kind of started tracking. And again, this is another thing I want to point out to people. You know, if you're paying attention to LinkedIn, and paying attention to the business influencers like Will here, you know, they're approachable. They're how you get to people today. And you and I networked just that way, right? And then all of a sudden we're here. And I am so excited to hear your origin story, the things in supply chain, and get to the startup that you're in right now. But before we do anything, enough of this, Will, start us off with a little bit of who you are and how did you get to where you're at?
Oh, man. First of all, I want to thank you for reaching out to me. I mean, it's the feeling is very mutual, you know, from the first time I started following you and we connected with each other. I just love the content that you generate and the people that you, you know, just have in your circle. So the feeling is mutual. I'm excited to talk to you. And yeah, this is we're on this really crazy journey. So I'll tell you. So I'm Will Drury, and I'm the founder and CEO of a company called Diagon. So Diagon is a marketplace for manufacturing and automation equipment. And it's kind of a really interesting story of how I got here. You know, I think, you know, people take different approaches to company building, but for me, you know, this is always an area that I've been very passionate about. I'm a supply chain manager by background, a self-described recovering supply chain manager. And so within supply chain, there are people who move things in logistics, transportation, you know, kind of third-party storage and things like that. And then there are people who buy things on the procurement side. So I was a procurement manager, and I spent most of my career sourcing machinery and equipment. So maybe getting into my origin story a bit, I started my career as a consultant and contractor for the Department of Defense. And so I spent, you know, the earlier part of my career sourcing machinery and equipment for companies, factories actually, in the Middle East, in Baghdad.
Oh my God.
Yeah, so I was,
and this is just so people can kind of get a sense as to what was going on. What was the time frame? What was happening in the world at that time?
So, the time frame is 2008. You know, I'm a kind of a government contractor working for PwC at the time out of Washington D.C., and you know, kind of young and highly adventurous. My partner approached me one day and says, "Hey, Will, I've got this really interesting assignment. It's overseas. You know, you'd be deployed for a year to go and work in the Middle East. Think about that." That sounds great. I'd love to travel.
All right. So first of all, let's just pause there for a second. Okay. That is not the average response of most people. All right. Well, I mean,
this was 23-year-old Will. So,
oh, okay. All right. So knowing what you know now, right?
I still would have done it. Okay. I'm just wired that way, as I think you probably know by now. But, you know, even after he told me the location, I started really just thinking about, you know, what was, you know, how meaningful really is this project, and what does it mean for, you know, the people that we're going to be working with? And so the way that this was, you know, kind of framed to me is that there were a number of factories that were located all around the country of Iraq. And essentially, these were industrial manufacturers of things like fertilizers, cement factories, leather tanneries, all sorts of, you know, really just important industries that were all in some sort of state of disrepair, either damaged during the war or neglected, just various states of disrepair. And so the Department of Defense actually appointed a task force to work with these factories and to help invest money into sourcing machinery and equipment, raw materials, electricity generators, just infrastructure projects to help these companies start to operate again. And the premise behind it was that in most of these areas where there was very high unemployment and disengagement from the workforce, that if you could get people to proactively be working in industry and doing something productive for society, then you know, you'd see more economic stability and physical stability.
And let me jump in on that for a second. And my tongue in cheek, immediately, I'm just thinking RPGs and IEDs, you're avoiding those for lunch. So not your typical work day. But actually, you also flew over it too. And another thing, because you're also a systems level thinker, right? And one of the things that popped out as you were kind of rattling through the industries, they sound like, I'm going to call them country-specific core industries, cement, fertilizer. I mean, these are the core elements that you're going to rebuild a country from. And did you begin to get into the sense of that? I mean, at that point, you're almost nation building.
Totally. I think it was, I won't say it was entirely lost on me when I started out on this, but when I started to think about some of the industries that we were supporting, we had a cement factory. And I'm like, you know, cement's important, but I had no idea at the time, based in Washington, D.C., that, you know, cement, this white cement that comes from this area in Fallujah, like this Anbar province, was the number one building material for houses, apartment buildings, and construction. Right. And so, you know, if you're helping that industry, you're now also helping out in the, for the construction industry. Right. And, you know, there are rubber tires, a tire factory that needed presses to make new tires or trucks to support logistics and transportation. And so, you know, these weren't just kind of off the cuff factories that, you know, that they were asking for assistance with. They were really important to the economy there. And really kind of by transitive property, I started to think about, you know, the U.S. and, right. You know, the Midwest. I'm a child of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, heavy steel industry. My dad and all my uncles worked in the steel industry. And so that importance kind of translated back to my upbringing. And that's really, it's one of the reasons why that was such a pivotal point in my career. And that's how it set the tone for everything I've done since then.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and again, I, you know, we don't have enough time in this episode. I could probably spend a full week with you digesting some of these things, but I mean, there must be one or two, and I'll just pick one story that just jumps out at you from being in that. I mean, that's just a rare opportunity, especially for the U.S., right? I mean, let's be honest, you know, in the U.S., I wish more people are out traveling around, getting perspective of the world. It teaches you more about the United States, you know, than being in it and kind of just locked in here. You really get a good chance to get out of the system and look back at it and go, you know, good things and bad things. But specifically to Iraq, and especially around 2008, I mean, it's a lot of people just don't know what's going on there. I mean, what kind of stands out to you from that time, anecdotally?
So anecdotally, I mentioned this factory, the cement factory in Fallujah. So for people that aren't familiar with Fallujah, it's like one of the cities in Iraq that had some of the heaviest fighting and resistance from, you know, ISIS. And it wasn't even called ISIS at that point. They were just insurgents. And I remember visiting this factory. So we would have these convoys where, you know, we were a team of three. So we had like a 5-car convoy, you know, lead truck, follow truck, and a few trucks in between. And, you know, we would do this pre-briefing ahead of time where they'd show us the route that we were going to take, red, yellow, green, but, you know, it's kind of like Google Maps, but instead of traffic, you're looking at, you know, incidents that have happened on those roads within the last 2 weeks. So
imagine the Waze report for that one, right? You're driving along.
This drive should have been a 45-minute drive. It ended up being about 3 hours to get there, to taking back roads and different things. And they set you up into different cars because if in the event something does happen, you don't want to lose the entire team and an incident. So, yeah, I remember these things. They felt so normal at the time. I think looking back, I'm like, man, that was kind of crazy. But
yeah, maybe.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about this factory, this one in particular, because when we went to visit, I remember meeting with the director general, who were like the government appointed CEOs of these companies, and them telling me about you know, how many people used to work at this factory and how, you know, the cement, this they needed these electricity generators to keep stable electricity throughout the day. You have unstable power. and the power goes out and you have cement tumbling, it ends up curing and freezing up all their assets. And it takes 24 to 48 hours to clean everything out and start a new batch. So I was like, man, okay, now I get it. That's super important. And so, you know, this director is telling us about how this factory is one of the tallest structures in the city. And because it was near the highway in the height of the insurgency, you would have these insurgents that go up on top of there and attack, you know, the civilians and other people that are going by on the highway. And I was like, I remember asking him like, man, that's so crazy. Like, what happened to, you know, to all those guys? Like, are they, you know, are they gone? Are they dead? And he's like, no, dude, they work here. And are you kidding me?
Wow.
So, you know, he goes on to explain that, you know, in economically unstable times and regions like this, you have people that wouldn't normally do bad things, but, you know, because this is a way for them to get stability for their families, to pay bills, to do, you know, the things they need to do. You know, it's really easy to fall by the wayside and to get involved in nefarious things like that. So, you know, at that point, I was still a little hesitant about doing factory walk.
Yeah.
It was enlightening for me that, you know, this was really important work. And again, you know, growing up in Pittsburgh and kind of the bust of the steel industry, I remember how that economic stability bred physical instability in neighborhoods that were once thriving and high employment and, you know, good income jobs. But in the absence of that, just seeing how things can fall apart. So, you know, maybe just kind of advancing the story a little bit. That's how I got into manufacturing. And that's really how this came to have so much meaning for me.
Well, I was good segue as well, too. And you're going to jump into the manufacturing and kind of we're going to get to Tesla and a few other things that kind of get us to Astra. But within that, as you make this leap here, another thing that started sort of dawning on me as I'm listening to you is you also were touching again these core industries specific to the nation building of Iraq. You know, you're talking about cement, fertilizer, and I'm assuming a few other things that were like core elements to building the country back up. And what I'm also hearing too is you also were at the point of natural resource extraction, you know, versus having to import that from other countries around Iraq. And that must have also been kind of again, you're a systems level guy, you're at industry points in the supply chain where you're actually at the raw resource and seeing how important and how close that has to be and how difficult in a conflict region like the Middle East, if you have to get raw resources outside of Iraq into Iraq and the constraints there. I mean, you're kind of learning at the very beginning of the supply chain.
Yeah, totally. I mean, before this Fallujah cement factory was operating again, they had to import that cement from Saudi Arabia and bottled water for like they came from the watering plants, came from Turkey and other places. So, you know, first of all, really just I got so much from that experience. And while I feel like my job was important, I really think that the people that we worked with were like, you know, the protagonists in their own story, because they knew exactly what things to ask for, what was going to be most important for them to get back up and running. And so, you know, just to feel like I had even a small part in that was an incredible experience for me, but also really just helped to set the stage for other things that I went on to do later in my career.
Yep. And that's perfect segue, because that then, I mean, again, people are going to go, all right, listening to this, they're going, all right, this guy's pretty interesting. And obviously knows a little bit of what he's talking about, Pennsylvania to Iraq. All right. Already I'm kind of thrown off. And then I'm going to war-torn nation building to Tesla.
Yeah.
help bridge that one.
Honestly, it wasn't that different. I spent most of my time in a dirty trailer out in the back of the factory. So, it was an incredible kind of transition. So, from there, you know, I moved back to the States and found my way out to Silicon Valley. I was working in the tech industry, one of the big tech companies, and loved the company, but really wasn't in love with my job there. And, you know, was just looking to get back to something that was more hands-on, making a physical product. And a friend of mine was telling me about this company, this electric vehicle startup that he just started working at. And he offered to bring one of his cars out to, I think it was my wife's birthday party. So imagine this guy rolls up in 2012 to a birthday party with a Model S. Everyone's skipping around on, out around Santa Clara in this thing. And I was like, okay, I'm a believer.
Yeah.
We're about this company. And so he offers to give me a walking tour of the factory. And we are, doing this walkthrough. And he's like, look, I've got a not so hidden agenda here. We have an entire team dedicated to buying parts for the vehicle, but no one managing the spend for the factory. So, I've got this, we're looking for someone to kind of manage that. And, it has to be easier than the work you were doing in Iraq. And, it turns out that was a lie. It wasn't easier, but it was literally really an interesting and awesome experience. So I took them up on the offer to join the team ultimately in 2013. And I was the first hire that they had to really manage this spend. And it was incredible because Tesla is such a vertically integrated place. I today feel like I was supremely underqualified to do that work. I'd say that's the case for most things I've done in life. But
you're being purposely modest because at that point, you can say that now looking back. But at the time, who were they supposed to hire?
I have no idea.
You know what I'm saying? Like, I mean, you're again, part of your, whatever gravitas, whatever you want to call it, is not only being in the right place at the right time, but you're an innovator, right? You're jumping into places, making change, catalyzing change. And to do that, by definition, you're kind of doing stuff that no one else has done before, right?
Yeah.
And you look back on that now.
Yeah, that's a space that I love to be in.
You're like, I get to be in Santa Clara. This is like cakewalk.
Well, it was incredible. I mean, I essentially was just kind of set, released into the wild there. And I got a few contact names for engineers to work with, and they're like, hey, I need you to work with John. John needs this source, a stamping press to build, metal parts for this vehicle. And, I would have to go out and find the suppliers that made stamping presses and doing the supplier sourcing, going to trade shows and, just different organizations that have metalworking unions of America that were able to introduce me to these companies. But then I had to find the right product that was like, all right, is the stamping press large enough to accommodate this body panel for Model X? Does it support aluminum? Is it a mechanical or hydraulic press? So there was all this product discovery that I was doing along the way. And, as I'm doing this and kind of becoming a sentient being doing this, right, I'm banking all of these things into a spreadsheet that's just like, okay, maybe this is the only time I'm ever going to have to buy a stamping press, but just in case it's not, I've got these three other data points for these companies that I know I can go back to. And it turns out 3 years later, when it was time to do that again, the engineers came to me and they're like, hey, you don't still happen to have that information on you, do you? And, lo and behold, I was always able to have an answer and at least a good starting point, if not, pricing and availability. So I started to become this go-to person for, presses, injection molding machines, battery packing lines, train winding lines, and just all these things. So, I really have a lot of my career to thank for that experience as well. I ended up sourcing in the billions of dollars of worth of equipment. And I've done lots of things since then, but really that's the thing that when I still have engineers that some that I've worked with during that time at Tesla. As it's seeded lots of other startups and people have gone on to work at companies like Rivian and Lucid and all these other places. And so now there's this really robust ecosystem of people, and we all still are in contact with each other thinking about like, hey, I know you know this person, or I need pricing on this tool. Do you have any idea? Here's what I'm being quoted. Can you help me, figure out if this is the right thing to do or not? Really just an incredible experience. I was there for about 5 years and ended up building a team of over 30 people that helped this company source.
That's amazing. Well, and also, because there's a method of the madness here. We're coming kind of back full circle to the beginning and opening kind of intro to yourself and what you're doing now. But there's a lot of, there's a progression. You're kind of in Iraq, and I'm hearing kind of the origination of kind of supply chain at its very fundamental level. Then you get to a company like Tesla where you get thrown at this thing, and also in a weird way, get to take your experience from Iraq and apply that now to Tesla with all that financial backing and what the education. But a lot of it is, as you keep saying, parts and sourcing the vendors and putting that all together. And there's a lot of manual process in there that seems to be a connective tissue to why you're doing what you're doing now, right?
Yes.
So, I mean, I can see that, you know, so the question I'm actually getting to before we get to what you're doing now is, you know, looking back a little bit, how do you see the progression going from what you were doing in Iraq to Tesla? Because I see there's actually a kind of a very path there that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the common theme there really for me was just learning about the context for which you're working in this environment and sourcing the things that you need. Really understanding and having an appreciation for your customer. You know, my customers there being director generals that, you know, have a need for this equipment, they specify it, and, you know, I help make that thing happen. And that really was the same dynamic that I had with the manufacturing engineers and equipment engineers that I worked with at Tesla, where, you know, they would dream up or design a line or a manufacturing process and then come to me to help, you know, make that thing possible. So, you know, that really was the common theme. And having an acute ear on what the customer needs and some creative lease to myself on how that gets done and what tools I build to do it, you know, that's really the thing that I enjoyed the most and the thing that made that a not so difficult transition from Iraq to Tesla.
Right. And within that too, and I know, and again, this is going back to the experience specifically within Tesla. You know, Elon's a pretty data-driven guy, and I'm just going to do my outsider view in. And I always used to tell people, and the handful of people that I've known at Tesla, you know, always talked about the data side, and even you know, cheeky kind of saying, you know, is it a car company or is it a tech company, right? And so where I'm headed now is, you also, I'm sure, were being driven. You yourself would do this anyways, but even the crowd you're with wanted to analyze everything about the supply chain from soup to nuts. Right. And so how did that data, because, you know, my journey with supply chain, I found it to be, you know, it needs digitization, right? Like it's lacking digitization, which is going to lead to the platform you're building as well too now. But, you know, what were some of the aha moments within Tesla? Because now you're kind of, you're beginning to build a view on what supply chain is like in the world and where are some of the gaps. And Tesla may have leapfrogged in front of some of these things as they did the entire automotive industry, because they were constrained by legacy thinking. And so that also gave you a jump start in digitization of supply chain, right?
Yeah.
Because you were doing things there that actually applied to the whole world supply chain.
Yeah, totally. And it's funny because when you're in the environment, you don't really have an appreciation for what other companies have done and, you know, who's not doing what. Like, actually, I'll tell you, Elon was very intentional about never comparing ourselves or doing reason by analogy for like what another company does.
Right.
And he's so such a first principles based thinker. You know, we always had to come up with the first principles, and I had regular meetings with him. So we, you know, he would ask me, you know, why, how, what do you understand about the cost structure of this production line? How do you understand, you know, why this is the right supplier? What type of technology, understanding, expertise do they have that no one else has? How well automated is this solution, and how is this going to help us be, you know, the you know, build the fastest and most automated production lines in the industry? And it was really interesting for me just kind of seeing the differences that are out there, because it might not be apparent to people that aren't close to supply chain or procurement, but you have these differences between the direct material side. These are parts that go into a bill of materials. You know, you've got a camera that goes in an iPhone, that's a direct material.
Right.
And it can either be custom or off the shelf. And if you have a custom thing, you're relying on someone else to make it. You might have some guidelines on what you want and how to make it, but you can be very prescriptive about what you want when that's what the part that you're getting. On the equipment side, that's categorized in this everything else category called indirect spend.
Right.
So indirect spend includes everything from you know, desks and chairs that, you know, populate the factory with, you know, factory and construction spend and capital expenditures for machinery and equipment, which is our really large spend categories.
Sure.
So in this world, those things are a lot less defined. You have fewer things at your disposal, and you can't always get exactly the thing that you're asking for. if you want a stamping press or an injection molding machine, you know, you've got to go or make a really good case to that manufacturer on why they should deviate and make a special product just for you, if that's the thing that you're doing. Well, it turns out a guy like Elon doesn't take no for an answer most of the time. And so I found myself in these development meetings with some of our suppliers where we were asking them to do things like modifying, dunk tanks for, painting and coating our vehicles. And in those meetings, I was able to get an understanding of how the equipment works, how you can improve upon the design that you already have, tapping into resources like R&D resources that these companies had at their disposal. And then ultimately, while I don't think they always enjoyed the experience, the outcome was that they had much better products that they could then go and market to their suppliers or their customers. And because we've gotten in this repetition of doing things really quickly and deploying equipment quickly at Tesla, they were able to do more projects in 1 year where they used to be able to do two or three. Now they were doing four or five projects a year and increasing revenue turns. Mm-hmm. So that was such an illuminating experience for me that, I was able to really take those principles and apply it to things that I went on to do later in the career.
Well, absolutely. And I think, and again, and this is where there's a thread here that's so interesting to me, because on the one hand, that I'm kind of putting my own brain, kind of simplifying, you know, Iraq is sort of this, like I'm throwing you at the very basic of the supply chain. Then you get a chance to really build a brand new supply chain via Tesla. And now that you've cut your teeth there, it makes all the sense in the world to go to Astra.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, pun sort of intended. I didn't mean that, but it's
to the stars.
Like, oh, okay, right. Yeah. Sorry, came out. But yeah. So then that, I mean, there's actually some, so there's a story that makes sense all of a sudden here. It's like, okay, I'm going to get the very beginning. I'm going to get thrown at it and pushed to really think about, you know, how to make a digital supply chain, because I'm unconstrained by legacy thinking around what supply chain is or isn't. And then, you know, Chris Kemp comes along and says, dude, I got to get a supply chain going for, you know, a rocket delivery company. It's going to go, well, rocket a month or whatever, whatever it was, right? You know, and how did, so that all of a sudden must have been, again, you're kind of asked to do the same thing again.
Totally, man. So, you know, it's funny because that makes total sense to me. Like, even on a trip, I'm like, man, that was like really well planned. And I'll tell you that in the moment, it was anything but that. Like, always crazy. You know, just thinking about what I wanted to do, you know, after I left Google and was looking at this role with Tesla. And, you know, there were so many times where, you know, I was just kind of exploring different opportunities. So when this opportunity came about with Astra, I was, you know, incredibly, you know, inspired by the mission and what they were doing. But I won't say that any of this stuff made sense forward looking. I think.
Right.
It all.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. We can make it all so it makes sense. 2020, man, I can make it all work out.
You know? Yeah, of course.
Sure made sense. Yep.
Why wouldn't I?
I put the bulletproof vest on. That totally made sense, man. I mean, I get it.
Yeah.
So jump in. So Astra, though, it really is actually kind of like now you're dealing in developing. Well, quite frankly, it's a new supply chain again, right? I mean, you're really kind of end running NASA. I mean, one of the things I've enjoyed about watching this, not you and just you, but, you know, people kind of really technical people going in and really changing, you know, bellwether industries and, you know, the rocket industry, space, whatever, for as young as it is. Again, we got to remember here, it's only, you know, moon was in the 60s, for God's sakes, right? We're only 60 years into space. It's not that old. So it's fairly young, but, you know, it was a monolith and it was a, you know, controlled by NASA and everywhere else. Okay, fine, great. So they kind of got stale, as it happens. Don't need to belabor that. But then all of a sudden, you know, you get SpaceX coming around and Astra and all these companies jumping into the game. It's inevitable. But you're asked to do a similar thing that, like, Tesla is an existing automobile industry, creating, yes, a new car, but you're asked to do a completely new, you know, way of thinking supply chain. And yeah, it's kind of similar to Astra, right?
Yeah.
But even more so.
Yeah, I would say on day one, there were a lot of things that kind of struck me where, you know, these companies are you know, maybe also really sexy kind of in retrospect. But I remember walking in Tesla on day one and, you know, we're going into this factory. It's really run down. There was like a bunch of old equipment that's kind of decommissioned and you literally referred to the parts of the factory as the dark side and the light side.
Oh, God. Oh, my God.
In this 5 million square foot facility, we had like 20,000 square feet that we were occupying where we were just like, you know, building some car bodies and doing some stuff. But you had to walk through, I mean, like hundreds of thousands of square feet to get to these, you know, pockets in the factory that were actually operating.
Wasn't that the old Solyndra or what was it?
It was the NUMMI plant. So,
oh, that's right. That's right. Because on the East Bay on 880 or whatever.
Yeah, on the right? 880, Fremont, yeah. California.
Yeah,
itself.
Yeah. It was huge.
Yeah, it's huge. It's massive. And there are multiple buildings there. So it was, you know, just incredible to see that that place come to life. But, you know, reflecting on my day one at Astra, you know, I live in Alameda and I've been on this naval base a number of times. There's like a Pottery Barn outlet and, you know, a few other things back there. But, you know, a lot of abandoned buildings and stuff. And I'm like, there's no way they're building rockets in here. Like, absolutely no way.
Uh-huh.
You walk in and it's incredible. You see these, you know, hypoxy floors and, you know, a 20,000 square foot machine shop, you know, rocket engines being tested and fired in an old facility that used to make jet engines. And so that was just really cool and awe-inspiring to be able to be there on day one. But I was scared shitless. Like, I don't know anything about rocket manufacturing.
No one's shooting at you, man. I mean, at this point, I can't even believe you said that. I mean, God, like you're literally dodging IEDs because Waze told you to, right?
That would actually be a great new product offering for Waze. Like,
that's what I'm saying. The Middle East version, man. I mean, you got like, hey, you know, here's a little, you know, a hazard on the side of the road. And I got my IED, but
totally. So I just you know, walking in on day one, the thing that would kind of apparent to me was that, you know, there was infrastructure and there were systems and other things set up in some of these other places that I come to, but really at Astra, this was the first time that I wasn't just responsible for CapEx or indirect. It was also, hey, you need to get the parts for the rocket too, all the direct materials. We need to get equipment to, you know, to make and fabricate things. I was also responsible for logistics, like getting all the parts to the factory and storing them in inventory, production control, which was a new element to this because, you know, it's not just the buying things part of supply chain anymore. It's also the making things. Mm-hmm. But then we were also responsible for planning, you know, the cadence of manufacturing and deploying the finished rockets from the factory out to the launch sites in Cape Canaveral and Alaska, Kodiak, Alaska. So that was a really large, you know, scope to kind of take on. So, you know, building out the team and the functions to be able to do that was, I don't really feel like I couldn't actually call myself a supply chain manager or a supply chain leader before that experience. But, you know, because I think that was really the thing I needed in order to feel like, all right, I know and understand enough about all aspects of it now to say that I've not just built it, but also managed it and, you know, kind of done something.
I'm being a little self-deprecating, but okay. I'll give you that last.
I slammed it. I qualified.
Yeah, I get you. But I mean, okay, fine. I'm, you know, you still did really cool stuff. So but again, that led you to want to build, you know, Diagon. So again, somewhere in there is a lack of cohesion or a problem you are trying to solve that you saw consistently over the last 10 to 12 years that no one had really solved. So let's dive into that. Because again, I think, you know, for all of the stuff that you've done, you know, and I think even when you look at the entire world supply chain of the 100 billion tons of things that we pull out of the ground every year to feed the $100 trillion economy that connects all 8 billion people, those are your three numbers. Yeah, there you go. Those are good ones to go. You know, that the supply chain is still woefully antiquated. We're trying to make digitally twin it, but you're creating a marketplace, and I'm going to tease a little bit of circularity in there because I'm assuming that is also part of this, right? You're starting to, because everything's been a linear supply chain. You're kind of getting into the parts, you know, that are getting in sourcing and how to do all that through your platform. But one other question I'm going to ask that's on the back end of me thinking strategically is, now this is the front end of sourcing everything, where on the back end are you thinking about the decommissioning and circularity of those parts?
Oh, got a lot.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. So I basically just asked you for your business plan. You know,
Sure. I mean, you can ask my pitch deck. No, on you. When I left Astra, I really left with this idea that, you know, I've always wanted to start a company, but at least let's say Tesla put the spark in me and Astra kind of gave me the confidence to do it. And I started thinking about like, what's the business that I'm the best suited to build? Like, if I don't build this, I don't know that it ever gets built. And I, again, in retrospect, these things look like, and like, they make a lot of sense, but forward looking, I wanted to build a lot of crazy stuff. And I had no idea that that was the right thing for me to do. And so I took this, you know, a few months of introspection to really think about, when people come to me and ask for advice and help with things, what is it most often that they're asking? And it started coming back to this infrastructure building where people need manufacturing equipment for to fuel their operations, to build the products that we all rely on. And a few themes started to get my adrenaline going. I started thinking about the supply base that I had for parts at Asheville. When we would ask for a machine shop, you know, in Arizona or wherever to make something for us, or, you know, a carbon composite shop to do something for us, I recognized that these lead times were getting longer and longer. And I think everyone feels that pinch. They all know and understand that at a basic level. But when I started to drill a level deeper than just how fast can I get parts into the why they can't start my job for another 6 months, it's really that there isn't enough manufacturing equipment and infrastructure to deploy on the American manufacturing base as a whole to support these industries. And that was something that was actually deeply concerning to me, because I realized that, you know, there are all these things that we say we want to do as a country and building out these capabilities and having our own autonomy. And I'm thinking about what this meant for Iraq during my time there.
Yeah.
Also at that same crossroads in the U.S. here today, when it comes to reshoring efforts and nearshoring, this is something that is massively important. Well, the thing that was apparent to me and clear to me from my experience using the tools is that there have been a lot of tools built to help people source the part directly that they want. You want an injection molded piece, we can connect you with a company that makes injection molded parts. You want a machined part, we can connect you with machine shops that make them. But in my career, I never had any tools, you know, really advanced tools to help me source the machinery and equipment. So if you're that machine shop or that injection molding shop that's thinking, I want to expand my capacity, that's still a very one-off thing where they're going to the machine tool builders, the suppliers, the distributors. They're looking for special types of financing, equipment financing, specifically for those types of programs. They're looking for special types of logistics carriers, because you can put a bunch of these into onto a pallet and ship them overseas really easily. Now, if you have a stamping press the size of an apartment building, or a CNC machine the size of a bedroom, a New York studio apartment, you're going to need different logistics carriers and customs brokers and other people to manage that. That was missing. And started thinking about the tool that I wanted as a buyer. This is really the thing that I set out to build. And every time I'm looking for my North Star in how I'm building Diagon and who I'm building it to serve, I think about the buyer, that person that is tasked with building up their capacity or expanding their capabilities to include new things like 3D printing, so that they can service new markets and new customers. How are we building this tool to serve those customers?
And totally get it. And absolutely. And I think in inherent in that, though, is because you're in complex projects at a simplified level, right? Because you're also describing things that have bill of materials, probably a fairly complicated RFQ process or whatever you want to, in there. And again, historically, you had to bolt together, if systems even existed, I got to have my finance system, I got to have my procurement system, I got to have my, my contact database, the people I want to get to. But where do I have one place that I can go, soup to nuts, start to finish? I need to go build this giant, three-story building press, like you described. It's comprised of, I'm just going to say, 15,000 parts. But I got to kind of put this bill of materials together. I got to put it out to an RFP. I got to kind of get things back. And then I got to buy it. And then I got to get it logistically delivered, assembled. And then I got to service it during its life cycle. then I got to decommission it.
Yeah. So think about that. It's, the goal with Diagon is to connect buyers of equipment with the sellers of equipment. And so I'm now, Will from 2013 and looking for this stamping press, I could either start by describing the type of press that I need. I need a, mechanical tandem press that can, that has a stamping bed that's at least these dimensions in order to accommodate a part. Aluminum is the material type that I'm loading into it. Find me products that can do that and the companies that make those and sell those products. Now, it sounds easier said than done, and there are a lot of really advanced companies, not just small startups. These are, large automotive manufacturers, aerospace and defense contractors, even big companies really struggle with this. So I set out to build this tool to make that really easy to describe the thing that you need and find it and buy it. I've got some pretty cool things that are on this development pipeline.
Yeah.
You tell me enough things about the product that you want to build, I can just use that information enough for me to match you with the right type of equipment and suppliers to make it happen.
Definitely we're in the world of supply chain platforms that are merging. It's a category onto itself. This decade is going to be marked as the decade of, digital supply chain kind of technology advancements. The biggest thing that's happening, I think, since the internet personally, and you're right in the middle of it. I mean, it's super cool. Now, I'm going to pivot a little bit because up until now, you've been kind of the leader of supply chain.
Yeah.
Now you're leading a company. So my question is, there's probably some big differences there.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Terrifying.
I don't know why anyone does this. It's like having two.
That's kind of where I'm going. I'm like, okay, like now you're taking on, the founder CEO role, which to the outside, everyone's like, oh yeah, that sounds awesome. Okay, man, what's the real story?
I'll tell you. Actually, one second. I'm going to plug me. I don't want to lose the matter.
Yeah. Go ahead. I'll pause for a sec.
I'm good.
Perfect. I had a pause. We can brought it back. We're all good. Yep, we're good.
Yeah. So, just this journey has been incredible. It is terrifying. I think just as I mentioned, you're really starting with just a vision and a dream or something that should exist that doesn't exist yet. And you've got all these problems. You've got to convince other people that this thing should exist. And unless you're starting with a cash cushion, got to convince investors that that this is something that is worthy of investment. Convincing your team, like my co-founder, bless him for joining me on this journey. I know this piece of the puzzle for sourcing the equipment, but I've never built a website. Like I'm not even the right guy to build like a Squarespace, let alone a marketplace. But thankfully that is his skill set and he's built lots of these things. So with the two of us working together, we're able to complement each other. But this is another part of it, is just having enough belief in the thing that you're building and instilling enough belief in other people that they're willing to join you on this journey. So all of those things have been going well for me, thankfully. It hasn't been easy. A lot of people talk about the difficulties of building a company in 2023 with headwinds on funding, valuation, all that stuff. I'll talk about the tailwinds because there are some massive benefits these days too. But, just convincing enough people to get on this journey with you and then convincing customers that this is worthy of their time and investment. That part of it, I'm actually finding to be the easiest because, I've been that supply chain manager and I think I understand and know enough of that pain, to feel like we're actually developing a painkiller for people in that position. In the world of startups, there are vitamins and there are painkillers. Vitamins are supplements, but, people are really experiencing pain and paying more and experiencing lead times and wasting a lot of time spinning their wheels doing this stuff. So we're helping to, solve that for the customers.
Well, you've also had a chance to work with a couple pretty significant innovators as well, too, in both Chris and Elon historically, right? And you've seen, I think Chris I think he was, I don't know if you remember, if he was a first-time CEO at Astra, but he did all his startup stuff, you know, in kind of the open source area. You know, Elon to Elon, obviously, but, you know, what looking back on those experiences is helping you form a company, right? Because building a supply chain, I get it, man. You got it. You got a vision. You're building a marketplace. So again, if it was just you and your partner, easy peasy breezy. But yeah. Now you got to build a team and you got to begin to allow that team to execute on your vision, right? That could argue, and I'm going to guess here, but having done this a couple times myself, I'm pretty sure that is going to be a huge lesson too, because you're no longer the guy doing it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And so like building the team, which is actually the thing I'd say I'm proudest of, and, you know, all of these supply chain roles. And again, like there are some great people that are supporting those efforts to help make these things happen. But like building the team, having accountability, with the team, and that the trust that comes along with that has really just been the most fun part of this journey. Because, you know, again, I'm not a software developer, but, you know, working with these teams, I'm able to understand enough about this customer journey to understand, you know, this is going to be a friction point, this type of checkout process.
Totally.
Here's the thing that's going to, help to get people on board. So if I were to take anything from what I've learned from Chris and Elon, it's really that they're both very resolute and clear in the vision that they set for the company and the purpose for why people are getting behind it.
Yep.
And so that helps to get people on board with not just the what they're building, but why they're building it. And I think we at Diagon, we all feel that way, that if we can't build the factories of the future with the tools of the past.
Right. Oh, we're bad. Dude, you know, just bookmark that with whatever that just said. I hope that's your tagline.
Full stop.
Yeah, it's like, there's the tagline. Like, put that in the business card. That's awesome.
Yep. Yeah. And so I wanted to touch on this too, because it's just, it's at the top of my mind. And yeah. I know a lot of people have questions about this too, but I talked about some of the tailwinds of starting a company in 2023. But it's just, we try to avoid joining the hype cycles on things like generative AI.
Yeah.
But when I tell you that, you know, as a 5-person company, we now have superpowers of a team of like 30, I'll tell you that like my co-founder and I are daily users of OpenAI and ChatGPT. They do our daily jobs and, you know, building some really cool capabilities into the product. We, users of like Copilot and other software development tools to help accelerate the development there. Our designers are able to use tools like Midjourney to, you know, conceive and come up with imagery for the things that we're developing. So all these tools that exist today are giving us this ability to build so fast and so capably that I really feel like this is one of the unique advantages that, you know, that comes with starting a company at this point in time.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because until you said it, I hadn't even thought about that with all the hype that's going on right now, but how that actually applies to someone building a company right now, right? And those tools help you accelerate in a way, you know, talk about first mover advantage, right? I mean, you get to jump and leap ahead people who aren't used to using those tools. And in fact, even a year or two ago, you know, they're probably already stuck in the legacy way of thinking, and you're unencumbered by that. That's really interesting. I mean, I never would have even thought of that.
Yeah. I mean, we don't see these things as like our company killer. I mean, we see
right.
these as incredible creation tools that we have. And so I think about that, not just for my company, but now you have to imagine that you have various teams of buyers, and some might be a really tech forward and, you know, well endowed companies with lots of cash, but others might not. Now by developing AI tools within our product that we can bring to them, we're giving them superpowers that they would never otherwise have on their own.
Right.
And for the suppliers in this industry, we're thinking about like machine tool builders, distributors, other, automation companies that are like the preeminent people at what they do. They build incredible systems, but may not be savvy when it comes to these tools and,
yep.
you know, building next generation, checkout, procurement, and technology on their own. we're now able to be a facilitator and a force multiplier for those companies. So that's one of the reasons why I feel like this is a super important thing for us to invest in, because now we see ourselves as a conduit to bring that technology to our customers and suppliers.
Ah, that's so cool. What a great story. Well, let me also start to wind us down a little bit, be conscious of time. I know we started a little bit late, but also be conscious of your schedule. So kind of looking forward, I mean, you've done the initial round, or what's the future? What's the next 12 months kind of look like for you guys?
Yeah, so we raised some good pre-seed funding.
Cool.
Yeah, so that's been great. That's gotten us kind of kicked off and off the ground. We're planning to release V1 of our product on July 4th, so maybe dating it a little bit, but
okay.
Incredible launch date, you know, yep. What you need to declare your independence.
Yeah.
We've got a limited audience of a few customers that will start with that pilot program, and we're planning to ramp and build from there. We'll probably raise again at some point, toward the end of this year, as we think about building and scaling to get to the next level.
Yep.
But we've made some pretty good progress, and I feel really excited about what we've got on the 4-month, 5-month roadmap.
Well, anyway, your energy is infectious. I will say that much. So it comes through loud and clear, and anything that you're doing, people should be paying attention to. But let me broaden just a little bit of the aperture for a second, and also get your view on where you see things going with supply chain. A couple things top of mind I'm going to loop into that question are, obviously, you know, where does digitization kind of come in, just at a broad level, right? Then also circularity. I kind of poked it a little bit. And that, for me, this is a hot topic. And so I'm selfishly injecting this. But I truly believe it's the right thing to do, where we've done a very poor job at, you know, you can't blame us. We grew out, humanity expanded, everything was linear. But now we're realizing that we're wasting a whole ton of stuff along the way across the entire supply chain. And so I kind of want to bring back the circularity a little bit. So really the question is broad to you. What do you see over the next couple of years in the supply chain changes that are happening and circularity in particular, how that's going to play a factor?
Oh, great question. I got a bunch of things. So first things first, we talk about reshoring and nearshoring. They don't just make sense from a national security standpoint, but also... Right. Just the number of miles that are on most products that you and I consume on a daily basis is absurd. So
yes, yes.
Invest in infrastructure that is close to home. We need to be building that. It will be worth the investment.
Right.
The other things are just thinking about this. While we might nearshore a lot of the end manufacturing, the sad truth is most of the equipment that we use and consume in the U.S. today still comes from overseas.
Yep.
So, as we're building up our infrastructure, we're going to need more machine tool builders that are building things like CNC machines, 3D printers, yep. robotics, and other things close to us, so that yep. as we expand and build our manufacturing base, we don't have to rely on so many outside forces in order to do that. So those are two things. The third thing is, I think that the way we think about material consumption is going to change.
Yep.
There's always going to be a need for things like subtractive technology, like CNC machines. But as you think about how machine parts get made, you essentially start with a block of material and subtract away everything else until you have just that part left.
Right.
It can be a really wasteful process where, you know, you might end up using only 15% of that actual block by volume. And again, a lot of that material gets recycled and reused, which is great. But I think that additive technology is starting to see its time, and that will continue to come to the forefront, so that you now have this duality of things that can add material and subtract it away, so that we just find better and more efficient ways of making parts. And then the last part, the other thing that I'm thinking about constantly with the machinery and equipment itself, is to this idea that this machinery and equipment has a long life cycle. So, for a stamping press, you might get a good 30-year lifetime out of a stamping press. You know, we bought used equipment that was manufactured in the 1980s and 1990s that are still in use today. So as I think about the equipment economy for used equipment, This is also something that we're really passionate about at Diagon and want to find a way to help reuse and repurpose equipment wherever it can be. It's something the buyers are asking for. You get better pricing and immediate lead time, which is are the benefits. But also from a reusability standpoint, that's going to be really crucial and super helpful to us as we continue to build.
Awesome. Great way to close. Great ideas of what's coming to the future. And like I said, almost if you connect the dots to where we started, we actually kind of came full circle, right? Back to how this all comes together. And, such a pleasure to chat with you. People can find you on LinkedIn. People can find you on Diagon. Super active in there. You're posting all the time. Any other things, shout outs to people or anything like that?
Oh man, shout outs to so many people.
Yeah.
My wife for being on this journey for me. She's
right. I mean, okay. So I got to ask this. Were you married at the time when you went to Iraq?
We were dating and we actually.
Oh, all right. She's a keeper. So kept you during that whole thing. For sure.
Totally a keeper. Nice. My family puts up with all the crazy things that I kind of put us into, but they're just amazing. My co-founder and my team, my co-founder Shri and Clara, they helped me build this thing from day one. My investors, Balia Ventures, Khaled, Riley, and Omar, they've just been incredible investors, better than I could have ever hoped for. So I'm just really glad to have great partners on this journey with me.
That's awesome. Well, good people attract good people, Will. So I know that's not going to be an issue for you. So thank you so much again. We'll wind up on there. Really a pleasure. And, everyone will be keeping an eye out for what you guys are doing at Diagon as well.
Thanks, Richard. And thank you for giving me a voice and a platform to talk about all this stuff.
Oh, my pleasure. Easy peasy breezy. All good. Cool. Thanks, man.
Thank you.